Hello everybody, and welcome to another edition of Ex-Premier Desert Island Discs. And the guest this week is Mike Finch, who a number of people might know from Divine Light Mission in the UK over a number of years. So welcome, Mike.
Thank you.
And maybe could you give us just a little bit of background, if you fancy it, about your early childhood and some general stuff about where your journey you made during those years.
Yeah, generally, let me see. Well, I was brought up in a sort of middle class, upper middle class, I guess, English household, private school, became a bit of a rebel in my teen years. In fact, a big rebel. I was kicked out of my public school I went to. And got into a hippie life, beatnik life, first of all. Then I woke up one day and I was no longer a beatnik, I was a hippie, and took a lot of drugs. And in the end, turned to Buddhism, and I spent a year in a Buddhist monastery. And then I met a Mr. Ron Jeeves, some of you might know. Actually, I'd known him before in Oxford, and he came down and told me about this little kid guru he'd found out in India. And I got hooked. So I spent the next 30 years in this cult following Miraji, who I guess some of your listeners know about, and have come out of it the other end relatively sane and healthy, or at least I think I'm sane and healthy. That's for other people to judge.
I definitely second that.
Anyway, so that's the short version. If you want the long version, I'm game for it, but that's the short version.
Yeah, I'm not sure we'll have the time for that. Now, okay. your first track, which is obviously going back slightly, I'm assuming, from your hippie days.
Yep.
Is Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley.
Yeah, that was fantastic. I was 8 years old when it came out, 1956. And I'd just gone to boarding school. I was a new boy at boarding school the first time I'd spending some weeks away from my parents. And I was very lonely and upset. And this this matron, I guess she was in her 20s. I mean, she's young now, but to an 8-year-old, she's like an elderly woman. Tried to cheer me up, and she had an old gramophone, and she said, listen, this record has just been released, and it was all scratchy and everything, but she played it for me, and I was absolutely electrified. I mean, I was absolutely turned around. It was like, oh, I don't know, an epiphany in Nirvana. I mean, it was a complete revelation. Not only did it cheer me up, but it kind of really hooked me into rock and roll for the next several years. And I was only 8, this is well before teenage. So it's very, very, what's the word? Very, huge influence, that particular song and that whole genre, that whole early rock and roll stuff. So that's why I picked it as my number one, my first choice.
All right, cool. I'd have to say, having gone through the boarding school thing, I think you're very lucky, bearing in mind age of 8 anyway, which is bloody early to be going to boarding school, but you're very lucky to have picked up music that early, because I certainly didn't till about 3 or 4 years in on that journey. But anyway, that's enough about me, because this is about you today. Let's go into Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your glad rags on. Join me, hon. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. When the clock strikes 2, 3, and 4.
Thank you.
and start a rock around the clock again. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock.
Well, Mike, that's I think we could say a chunky and very lively track.
Yeah.
And especially buried in my British culture at that time, pretty damn raw. If I remember rightly, Tommy Steele, Frankie Lane, which is what I grew up on, and that stuff was really... So you were very lucky to get in on stuff that early.
Yeah, no, I think I was. I mean, and it lasted as well. Shall I move on to the next track?
Yep, we certainly can do, because they're definitely from similar time, aren't they?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing, my next choice was Elvis Presley, Hound Dog. And the thing about Bill Haley, which is really interesting, and all that genre, including Tommy Steele and the people you just mentioned, although their music was, like, raw, if you looked at them, if you ever saw them on stage, they look very traditional. I mean, if you couldn't hear Bill Haley, actually, the noise, the music that was coming out, you'd think they were, could easily be a sort of combo band from the 30s or something. They wore, you know, tuxedos and, you know, normal short hairstyle and everything, and look really straight and normal. The thing about Elvis, when he first came out, the music was kind of similar in the same genre, the same raw rock, but he actually looked, he actually played a whole different part. He was a rebel, you know, through and through, whereas Bill Haley and Tommy Steele and those people were just sort of rebels in their music. And this is a bit... you know, simplification, but that's how I see it.
Yeah.
So Elvis came out and took the whole thing one stage further, from my point of view. And this was, like you said, the same time in those early, from sort of 8 to 12 in my boarding school. We had the access to a gramophone quite a bit of the time. And this matron I was talking about, you know, bought a lot of rock records. She was clearly into rock herself. So seeing Elvis... at least I didn't see him live ever, but just seeing him on stage and his pictures was just, you know, one stage further of a whole, I don't know, rebellion, I guess you could say. Sounds corny to say these days, but in those days it really was a rebellion. It really was
indeed.
A complete throwing out of all the established humdrum, you know, plodding days. I don't know how to describe it exactly. So long ago.
I always think of the 50s as being black and white.
Yeah.
And that stuff, to me, was the first sign of colour coming in.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Elvis was... and all those around him. I mean, I guess Cliff Richard was a sort of the English Elvis, some people called him. But he, again, looked kind of straight.
Yeah.
He kind of looked like Bill Haley. But Elvis, you know, with his hairstyle and his, you know, fancy jackets and the whole vibe behind him, that whole sort of Marlon Brando bad boy vibe was... I don't know, really cool. I mean, you know, I was only a little kid, not even a teenager, but it really grabbed me and set the course of my life in some ways.
All right. Well, let's go on to Hound Dog by Elvis Presley then.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, you're crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time.
High class. Mad stuff. And I can't imagine in England, I mean, I only really became aware of English culture like early 60s. I just cannot imagine how he went down over here. I should imagine just very threatening.
Yeah.
And just so sexual as well, isn't it, in the whole presentation as well, although probably you wouldn't be picking up on that at that age. But
I wouldn't pick up on the sex bit, but certainly, you know, the sort of gyrating of the hips and the fact that he freaked normal people out so much.
Yeah.
That was always really cool, even though you hadn't actually seen him. The fact that, you know, people were getting so completely freaked out, adults were getting so completely freaked out, you know, he was the worst of the worst and the devil incarnate and everything. I thought it was really cool. He was my hero for no other reason.
Right. Right. Now, the next one is a little bit of a time gap. So maybe could you just fill us in a little bit, like maybe the journey that you made from the post-Elvis stuff to the choice of your next track?
Can you remind me what my third track is?
Yeah. Bad Moon Rising. By
This is interesting. What happened was, obviously, I could only pick a certain number of songs. Yeah, that whole kind of rock genre stayed with me through into the early teens. But as an actual teenager, certainly in my early teens, music ceased to be kind of so important for me. And I became, I guess, in a sense, acting out the rebel. I went to a prestigious English private school, which in England are called public schools, Marlborough College, which was very, I don't know, it was kind of interesting. I was certainly the rebel. You know, I went gambling in the betting shops, which had only just become legal then. I was, you did a lot of smoking, tobacco smoking and drinking, and in the end got expelled from that for running over one of my housemaster in a car that I'd stolen. So I wasn't your typical public school guy. Very rebellious. And of course, as soon as I left public school, I went straight into what was then the beatnik culture. This is in like mid-60s, 66. You know, I went traveling, hitchhiking out to the hippie or the beatnik, you know, heavens out east, Eilat in Israel and so on, Turkey, and got into dope a lot. And when I came back, I went up to Oxford University in the, about 67, I think it was. I had very long hair and was smoking a lot of dope, and kind of got back into music again. Music then became part of my life, which it hadn't been for the last several years. And a lot of the music of the mid-60s, once I'd caught up in it and got back into it, I know it really took me somewhere, I guess you could say. I think that's what good music does. By good, I mean music that grabs you. It does exactly that. It grabs you. It's not just muzak, you know, the kind of tinkly stuff you hear in the background, but it takes you and it moves you somewhere, whether it's classical or pop or rock or any genre. If it grabs you, that's what it does. It grabs you. Grabs is a good word. And that kind of, you know, beatnik, hippie kind of rock music of the 60s grabbed me again in the same way that, you know, the early rock Elvis and Bill Haley had in the 50s. But again, taking drugs and all that, everything changed a bit. And so my next two or three choices are sort of from that era. Did you say Bad Moon Rising was the next one?
Yeah.
Creedence Clearwater Revival was great. I mean, they were sort of, I mean, there was so much I could have chosen. I feel kind of, so much I wanted to put in. You know, I'd have loved to put in some of the early Beatles or some of the Stones particularly. I just chose this one because it's kind of raucous. Bad Moon Rising is kind of raucous. And in those early stages of just smoking dope, that's the kind of thing I liked. I liked sort of raucous music. And that's why I picked this one.
All right, let's go into Bad Moon Rising by Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Time today. Don't go around tonight.
interesting. Well, that's certainly the first one that I can remember really being alive to. But the thing that comes up when I'm listening to it, and the same, certainly to most of the tracks, they've surprised me a little bit, because I remember when I first saw you at Satsang, there was a gentleness in your demeanour, which I really liked, and yet a lot of the tracks you've chosen are very, what would I say, very chunky, quite male, and that quite surprised me.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. I'm not quite sure, as I say, in a choice of eight, and there are some more melodic, softer tracks coming up, I think. One of the things I liked about Creedence Clearwater Revival was I read somewhere that they chose that name to take the piss out of the religious Bible right. belt stuff in the southern states.
Right.
Which appealed to me.
Right, okay.
So that gave him a bit of an edge.
Right.
You know, and Fogarty was quite a character, him and his brother. So, yeah, I do like the raucous music. But quite often I like kind of sitting still and just getting absorbed into it. There's raucous music that you bop around to, you move your body to, and there's raucous music that you, you know, chill out and, you know, lie down or sit still and just let take you.
All right.
So I don't remember ever dancing to this or bopping around to this.
Right, okay. So it was more like stoner's music for you then.
Yeah, powerful. It was powerful music.
Yeah.
Drove something in and drove something out.
Right, okay. And I mean, from the more gentle end then, obviously that was a part of your life then. What kind of more gentle or less chunky stuff would you have been listening to then that would have been as important for you?
Probably not at that point, as I'm saying, that came a bit later.
Right.
Now, I think as a person, I think it's kind of paradoxical, but I was very much listening to music as a prime activity. What music wasn't something you had on in the background.
Right.
Music wasn't an activity that I'd be, you know, doing something and then listening to music as a background, you know, space filler. Music was an activity. You actually sat down or lay down or found yourself lying down, you know, listening to music. And that was like the prime focus for, you know, 10 minutes or an hour or 2 hours, whatever. So therefore the gentleness was in a sense, you know, mellowing out.
Right, okay.
And focusing on this. I noticed when raucous music is on in the background and you're doing something but the space around you is just filled with loud raucous music, it tends to affect you in a different way. You either start bopping around or you kind of get speedy and a little bit frenetic. But just listening to this kind of music in a very focused way, I know it sounds a bit paradoxical, but I don't think it's that heavier thing.
That's an interesting one, and it's, I mean, obviously from the way you were saying, music was quite a core passion for you then.
Oh yeah, definitely. Especially when I started smoking and everything, and got into that sectors thing, it was a big thing. It was something, like I said, that moved me. It was something that took me from the inside and took me somewhere in a good, not always a good place, but very often a good place. It was definitely a something very cool, something I enjoyed doing and was meaningful.
And would that be true of the mates that you were hanging around with then, the people that you were close to? That was a shared.
Yeah, I think so. I think the people I was hanging around with then, which I said we called ourselves beatniks, this was before the word hippie came on the scene.
Right.
Around 1967, we were beats, rockers, if anything. I think there were this is a huge, gross simplification, but there were two. There were people who were just trying to deaden things.
Right.
Just wanted to pass out and deaden everything. And there were people who I think was struggling to find something. Now, I think most people had actually both characteristics. So I don't want to say they're two types of people. I think there's these two streams which are in most people of that time. And there was in me, there was a deadening. There was definitely a pain to existing, and I just wanted to deaden it. But there was also an aliveness. There must be something better than this. My, you know, the, my idea of hell or my worst nightmare was to sort of live and be the same as my parents or my parents' generation.
Right.
Not to put them down, or to, you know, think what they did was bad, because it wasn't in that time and place. But not to duplicate it, but to move on and find something else. That was a huge motivation.
Okay, so you were already starting to make an internal journey towards something else that you were after then.
I was thinking of it. I was struggling. I was like a blind person in a room,
right,
clattering into the furniture, but sort of struggling around, thinking, "Hell, is there an exit here?" kind of thing.
Right. Well, I might be guessing badly here, but that rather nicely takes us on to the next track, which is like Jimi Hendrix's Purple Haze.
Yeah, that was hugely significant because, like I said, I remember it almost instantaneously. I went to sleep one night, a dope-smoking beatnik, and I woke up an acid-taking hippie next morning. It was, like, really sudden. I just had to change my clothes a bit, make them a bit more... spray a bit of paint on them, and put a few glitter here and there. And with that change was a whole different thing. It was definitely an expansion of consciousness. Whether acid really does expand your consciousness or make you go insane, I don't really want to get into it. But certainly for me, at that time, it opened a huge possibility.
Right.
And Jimi Hendrix was the defining moment of that, particularly when he appeared at Alec Pally, whatever it was, 68 or something, and I went to see him. That Purple Haze, when it first came, I think I first heard it on Top of the Pops or something, absolutely ridiculous. But I immediately knew this was a new stage, you know. Dope smoking beatniks were out. something new had come in.
Okay, so it was definitely a way much further movement on.
It was huge. It was great. It was like, I felt it in myself, and also I felt it in society as a whole. It was like one of these synergy things. It was, you know, those 60s were moving out of that, you know, dope era into the acid era, and the, you know, and I was right there making the turn with everyone else.
I must admit, I'm exceedingly jealous that you got to see him live.
Well, I didn't actually see much of him, because I remember I was there, and I just collapsed against the wall, one of the side walls, and was pretty much out of it most of the...
right.
most of the time, to be honest.
One of the weaknesses of that era, I think.
Yeah.
For definite. Right, well, let's go into Jimi Hendrix's Purple Haze, then.
Cool.
Just the end of time.
hell. And I'm getting the hairs up on my arm. I'm getting mild acid flashbacks, and I'm here punching the air and like, yes. I think it must have had almost a profound effect on me.
I think it did everybody. I mean, yeah. Whether you got into acid or not, just as a, you know, as a turning point, as a movement, as a new, you know, a new attempt to strike out and do something, a new attempt to move forward in the way I was talking about before.
Yeah.
It was hugely significant, whether you got into acid or not. Most of the people I knew did, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I must admit, it was the same in our crowd as well. That was just about, I was a little bit younger than you, but Hendrix was the trigger point for me, I think. And I've got a feeling it was seeing him on Top of the Pops again as well, which is quite amusing, really, at boarding school, seeing Jimi Hendrix. And I suddenly thought, and I'm looking around the boarding school and I'm thinking, I'm seeing all the bollocks that's going down with the teachers and the authorities. And then I see Jimi Hendrix on Top of the Pops, and really, there was no competition. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
It was straight down that route. It was just so fresh, so alive, and just felt like huge possibilities. You had no idea where it could go, but you knew damn well it was going to go somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jimi Hendrix actually got banned from Top of the Pops after the first couple of times.
Yeah.
Once the BBC realised, you know, what a subversive influence he was, I don't think he was allowed on. Not because he did anything bad in the studio, but just because of the way he was.
Yeah.
And of course, that made him even cooler by far.
Yeah, you know that.
Magnified
too.
His cool factor at least tenfold.
Big time.
Big time.
Well, and in a similar era, the next one, Strange Brew by Cream. I'm assuming that's a similar kind of thing for you. Is that a further development?
I think a bit further development. The interesting thing I find about Cream and that sort of whole style of music is that it can pretty much fit any mood. You know, the Jean Mayall and Clapton and Ginger Baker people can do rock, and it can be rock, but it can also be very mellow. And Strange Brew, I particularly remember as being this kind of song that was an appropriate track to listen to no matter what space you were in.
Alright.
It was an acid, you could listen to it on acid, you could listen to it on dope, or you could listen to it, you know, if you just sort of really spaced out and, you know, had too much of the stuff you're going to come on to next, you know, the heroin or whatever, the negative stuff, and just laid out, you were there as well. It was a brilliant, you know, one size fits all. And I think, acid, for me, I saw the danger of acid, and after a while I could see that it wasn't, you know, tune in, drop out, Timothy Leary and all that was a great idea, but for me there was something missing. It opened a possibility, it like opened a door, but didn't help you go through the door, but at least knowing the door was open, that there was an open door,
right,
was hugely significant. But I still needed to find my own way through it, and acid wasn't going to take me through it.
Well,
so,
okay.
You know, I went into other kind of drugs, and Strange Brew is a pretty much both the name and the name and the title, Strange Brew, and the, you know, the whole vibe behind it, it pretty much sums up my state of mind, you know, a little while after that Hendrix era.
Right, and I mean, you're talking about, obviously you did a fair bit of acid then, and did it? I mean, just linking it in with further developments, was that whole sort of Eastern mystical thing, was that starting to become an interest, or did that not really start coming on the agenda for you until a bit later?
It didn't really start coming on the agenda, but I remember at the time of taking acids, a couple of people, friends, were telling about these yoga books they'd read, you know, meditation. But meditation then was just put over as a sort of... you know, an even more cool form of acid where you didn't have to score it, there was no chance of getting busted, and it was kind of safer for you. So it's basically a meditation then, if it was on the horizon, but it was only on the horizon as a sort of superior form of acid, which for some people maybe that's good enough. So it wasn't what you might call, you know, spiritual stuff. It was just quicker and easier and better way to get high.
It's just the faster route without the grief.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's right.
Okay. Okay, let's go into Strange Brew by Cream then.
All right, all you groovy, tuned-in, turned-on, way-out fans, here's a sample of your kind of music as we feature Eric Clapton, Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce, otherwise the Cream, in Strange Brew. Performance by the Cream of the number from their latest release, Strange Brew.
Well, Mike, you've given me some flashbacks there. Not so much acid ones like I had on the Jimi Hendrix one, but it just took me back to boarding school. I can remember when somebody brought in, I think I was offered Disraeli Gears, wasn't it? The album? Was it Disraeli Gears?
I can't remember. I think I used to play it off the Best of Cream.
Right, okay. And it definitely, it was for me, that was the first time where I started... Hang on, these are British, they're not American. The journey's happening over here. It's part of our culture as well now, and I can remember that definitely made a big space for me to like entry into something else rather than just reading about it, getting excited about it, etc. As we were from the media and in the news because of everything that was going down during that period. So the next track, which is I definitely think we can fair to say is a slightly different vibe, is Heroin by Velvet Underground. So maybe you could just describe the sort of transition from that Hendrix Cream stuff to...
Yeah, well, for me, the whole drug thing kind of... I went out in a blaze of glory, basically. I didn't think of it as glory at the time, but... You know, I'd sort of given up on acid, and I guess there was a certain extremism in me. I just wanted to go take things further and further. And pretty soon, you know, certainly, you know, dope smoking beatniks and acid taking hippies all seemed pretty tame and conventional.
Right.
And yeah, and so I got into the heavy stuff. You know, I became really, yellow. I was as yellow as, bright yellow, bright yellow skin through jaundice, and took a lot of, you know, coke and heroin, mixed them up, and got into a really bad way. And there was very, very little music I found that could follow me into that space.
Right.
All the stuff we've played, which now I think is great, but at that particular phase, it was just, you know, it was average, you know.
Yeah.
Most people were doing it. And Lou Reed and Velvet Underground were one of the few bands that were, that seemed to me would really come into the space that me and the group I was with were in then. Because with hindsight, it was really dark and black, and in fact, a lot of my friends never came out. Most of my friends, in fact, from that era, you know, died at that point.
Scary. Are we talking lots of people?
Quite a number of people. I mean, the people I know. I mean, there was a group of, say, 10 other close friends I had, and probably, you know, then obviously a wider groups of some hundreds, but it was quite common for people to die in that period, in the group I was in. You know, obviously I'm lucky not to be one of them. There was several kind of scary stories. But as far as the music's concerned, there was very little, all the music that was then hip and the rave and was kind of conventional. It was something that I kind of looked down on then.
Right.
And Lou Reed was great. He was up there with the extreme stuff, and so I loved it for the, you know, few months before I sort of came out of it all with a big thing, with a big, I say, the blaze of glory. And I don't know what to say. I chose it, not so much, I don't know what it would even sound to me now, but it was highly significant. I mean, I remember just playing this track and others off his 2 LP. I think there were two, Velvet Underground with Nico, and then White Light, White Heat a bit later. And sometimes we just spend days listening to these records over and over again. So I put them in the list because it was significant.
Significant in your life. And what could we be specific about what year this would be for you now?
I think we're in probably, are we in 68?
Yeah, I was wondering if it was 68, 69.
68 or 69. I mean, to be honest, I've forgotten completely. But yeah, late 60s. Certainly.
Yeah. Right, okay, so let's go into Heroin by Nico and the Velvet Underground.
Sure.
Nullify my life, 'cause when the blood was a mana to my vein, needs to a center in my head, and then I'm better off and dead. Because when the smack begins to flow, I really don't care anymore about all the Jim Jims in this town, and all the politicians making busy sounds, and everybody putting everybody else down, and all the dead bodies piled up in mounds.
For anybody else, but I found that a bit dark. I always had a bit of a problem with Velvet Underground because of the darkness associated with it, and I had a couple of friends that I lost because of that. It didn't come into our circles that much at all, but yeah, well, that was the downside, I think, of that period.
Yeah, no, it was real dark. But then, as I said, I kind of came out of it with a snap, when I with a some bad overdoses and hospitals and psychiatrists for a year or so after that, several months anyway. And then that's when I first turned to what you might call religion or spirituality with a vengeance. It was like,
right.
Okay, well, the whole drug scene of any kind, you know, isn't going to take you anywhere except down.
Right.
What else is there? And there was such a fear and a negative emotion and sadness within me that there was like a desperation to find some meaning to life. So the question of, you know, who am I, and these typical philosophical questions, you know, what's it all about, really took on an urgency. And, I mean, my next song isn't until, you know, 30 years beyond this point.
Right.
And that's kind of significant. I mean, it's not that nothing happened in those 30 years, it's more that music didn't play a big part in my life, which is what I'm basing my 8 tracks on.
Right.
So anyway, I spent a year in a Buddhist monastery, trying to find myself and all that. And then this person I'd known in Oxford, who'd been a, you know, beaten hippie with me, Ron Jeeves, he'd been to India meanwhile, and while I was in the Buddhist monastery, and he'd found the Indian Guru Maharaji and come back, and his big mission was to turn on all his old friends who were still around. So he winkled me out of this Buddhist monastery and you know, told me about his Guru Maharaji, and I got hooked. Again, to me at the time, it was kind of representing, I was in this Buddhist thing, which was a bit of a struggle, being in the Buddhist monastery, but, you know, I've been Meraji was presented to me like the Royal Road out of it, you know, a quick, fast helicopter ride along the path to you know, Kingdom of Heaven, salvation, Nirvana, whatever. And although over the next 30 years I spent in this cult, following this guru, I don't know how much you want to talk about it.
As much as you want to, Mike, because this is your desert island disc, so as little or as much as you want is fine with me.
Well, as far as musics went, I mean, although there was music in these 30 years, now I think of these 30 years as quite dark, really, from sort of 1970. Summer 70, I got Meraji's knowledge and pretty much came out publicly in 2001. And for those 30 years, I really gave myself to Meraji, hook, line, and sinker. I mean, it was dedicated everything, my life, my hopes, my dreams, everything. And music wasn't a part of that. In fact, music was spacey. Music was, you know, back to the people who talked about Elvis, you know, the devil's work. It was
right.
And yet, I will say that's not true. There was a lot of music. There was premier bands. That's... some of the music I didn't think was so bad. So there was music around, and obviously lots of people who were in the cult still, you know, enjoyed music. I'm just saying I didn't, and there was nothing really significant. When I came out of the ashram in the early 80s, the ashram being living a sort of renunciate lifestyle throughout the 70s, dedicating yourself to God, is what we thought we were doing. Obviously I got into the music a little bit of the early 80s, and if I had to make my list of eight all over again, I think I would have probably included Bat Out of Hell or something from Meatloaf.
Right.
Because when I came out of the ashram, I did try to get back into this, you know, the kind of music that excited me.
All right.
You know, definitely the Meatloaf kind of it, the Cocteau Twins, all that kind of stuff. Dexys, Midnight Runners, I remember all the stuff from the 80s, but I think the reason when I made up my list I didn't put them in was because actually Meraji won, or my commitment to him won, and I, even though I'd left the ashram, I was still a fully paid up devotee, a fully paid up premie, and it just wasn't cool to get into music. It wasn't cool to get absorbed into music. Now, of course, that was me and my interpretation of devotion, but you know, Meraji was kind of strong at that time about, you know, he never read a book, and the whole idea of doing any activity for its own sake, doing any activity to take you anywhere, was spacey. It was considered, you know, bad. You were in your mind. The only activity to focus on was activities that he, the guru, sanctioned or commanded you to do. Meditate in his particular style of meditation. You know, listen to satsang, do service, go and see him. And anything outside of those sets of activities that he'd ordained, you were in your mind. And I think that's a great shame. I don't know how appropriate it is to get started in all of that, because, you know, I think...
What we put ourselves through was
kind of pretty negative.
Yeah.
I've got a lot to say about it, but you know, really, I don't think now is a whole lot to say about it. It was a 30-year kind of black hole, certainly as far as the music is concerned. And the idea of giving myself, well, that's really what we did. We gave ourselves to an outside power. I think with hindsight, going back to the beatnik and hippie and drug eras, we wanted to move forward, we wanted to take something and go with it, but we couldn't find the way to do it. So when somebody came along who promised he could do it for us on our behalf, or at least lead us by the hand, I think we were just so grateful. Okay, I made a complete mess of it so far.
Right.
Here you are, Guru Meraji, take my life, lead me, you know, lead me to, you know, the promised land.
Right.
So I think it's quite natural to do that, but it's a very you know, it's a very very negative thing to do, to give your authority away like that.
I mean,
natural, but not a helpful thing. Sorry.
Right, no. I mean, the thing that strikes me is, I mean, going through your lists, you were basically all the way down the line up till, well, Velvet Underground as well, you were in what I would call the early groups who got into stuff. You weren't hanging around. You weren't coming afterwards. You were always like forging on at pretty much the edge of where the culture was at that time. And yet, all of a sudden, you're in a period where you go a long time where you don't do that. I mean, I just wondered if there's any key element there, because that is almost like a bit of a paradox in a way as well. It's not like you're somebody who could be easily led off in a route that you don't want to be going on, or if you were in a route where you weren't completely happy, you would put up with it. You strike me as somebody who would just drive past that. So just from that specific angle, I was wondering why you thought that happened for you.
That's a good question. I'd love to know the answer. I mean, I was certainly in the forefront of, you know, actually joining Meraji. I was the exact 100th person to get knowledge in the West. The Mahatma who gave me knowledge, this was in 1970, wrote down a little list of everybody he'd given knowledge to, and I noticed, you know, I was number 100. So that was kind of pretty early, spring 1970. So I got in for it, but I think once you were into that kind of cult, I got hooked. I don't know what else you could say. It's like I was hooked into it. There was that drive to go forward. The feeling was that Meraji could make that drive happen. So the feeling of wanting to get driven somewhere, the feeling of wanting to move from where I am to somewhere better was very much there. The mistake was to think that it could be done for me by this guru. And the more it didn't happen, as the years went by, and the more it didn't happen, then the whole cult was set up to make you believe that it was your fault it wasn't happening.
Right. Okay.
You weren't surrendering enough to the guru, you weren't being devoted enough, you didn't practice meditation hard enough, you weren't giving enough money, you weren't doing enough service. And unfortunately, I bought into it. So I think the actual movement to drive on, like you say, was still there. It's just I was trying to drive up a dead end. My wheels were revving, but I was stuck in this sort of dead end, you know, sand pit. The wheels were just spinning, going nowhere. But a lot of energy was going into, you know, forward motion.
Yeah.
But there wasn't any actual motion because the wheels were just spinning in this quicksand.
Yeah.
That there was the guru and his message and his belief system. So I don't know if that's what you meant, but
for definite, and that was the kind of territory, because and the part of the reason why I asked you that question was is that I think the first time I came across you in the context of that environment was, bearing in mind that I never was a gung-ho ashram premie, I was always one of those very outside suburban premies who was basically much more in control of their own life, even though it still had a very profound effect on my life. But I can remember one of the things that I always had problems with a lot of the time in Satsang was that premies were so unconnected in general, it seemed to me, with the world outside. And I can remember going to Palace of Peace in South London one night. I used to go regularly to these nights, and those were the science. There was a short period where they used to have satsang which was around science and knowledge, and I can't remember if it was you that got me into Fritjof Capra and that whole Buddhist almost second order cybernetics approach to reality. And well, you were certainly bloody classy in that satsang, and one of the few of those science nights, even with my limited understanding, that I felt had some authority with it. So, I mean, I just wondered how you balanced up that part of yourself with that as well, because, I mean, I'm assuming that wasn't just some arbitrary thing that you'd been reading before you got into knowledge, but that was all part of computer-related whatever. I don't know if I'm guesstimating wrongly there.
Yeah, I don't think computers back in the early 70s, but certainly the... Yeah, I remember those nights. I think we call them intellectual satsang.
That might well have been the right title, yeah.
Yeah, for some reason. I don't know. I mean, it's the whole problem of being in the cult is that you can appear very normal and sensible and talk well and, you know, talk from your skill set outside the cult, but there comes a point when the cult belief system steps in. And Fritjof Capra is interesting because I knew him. I was writing a book at that time under Balva Gwangi's instruction. Balva Gwangi was Maharaj's elder brother. By the time I finished the book, the family split up, and so my book got trashed because he told me to write it. And Fritjof Capra had just written his first book. I've forgotten what it was called, Tower of Physics or something.
Yeah, Tower of Physics, indeed.
And we had quite an exchange, and he was quite interested in my ideas, and I was quite interested in his. And we were swapping ideas. And then this whole thing about me being in this cult, of course, we didn't call it a cult then. Nobody ever thinks of themselves in a cult. No. Cults are always what other groups are. Yeah. Your group's never a cult. Your group's, you know, the truth and the royal road to liberation. But when I started talking about Miraji, and he switched off like anything. Of course, with hindsight, that was brilliant on his part, and it was clearly the right thing to do. But from my side, I thought that he'd got so far, but here was the Lord with the royal, you know, the holy cherry on the top of the cake, cherry on the icing on the cake, you know, to make it all real and possible, and he was just turning away. So I was kind of very sad at that. But it highlights what I think you're saying, is that there is a certain amount of, you know, just human skill you can do as a premie.
Yeah.
But it's always capped, and it's always surrounded, and it's always, in the end, throttled by this belief system.
Yeah.
And that was a tragedy. And so, yeah, I mean, I was interested in science and always wanted to think for myself, always trying to do the best. But always I smothered myself by this belief system from this guru of how he was the ultimate and I have to give everything to him and all the crazy philosophy and belief system which went with it. And that was a tragedy, and that's why, you know, it kept me going for all those years. And I mean, I'd love to know why. So often I meet people like him back then, and so many people now even who met Miraji in their past but saw instantly or within a day or two,
yeah.
you know, what a con it was and how destructive it was, and left. So why I stayed in it for 30 years, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that's going to be an interesting journey for you to explore if you want to be interested in that. Certainly, I know for me, I think it's taken me almost as long as I was around that environment to really start getting quite clear about what the weaknesses and motivations and the delusions that I was experiencing during that period. I don't know if that's true for everybody, but
I think once you the interesting thing about Miraji is that it all rests on faith that he is, you know, the Lord, the number one, the person who has this mysterious grace, has the power to save you. And all you have to do is just not accept that, stop believing in that, and everything else about it falls apart.
Yeah.
It's like it's very fragile. It looks like this monolithic, strong tower, but with just one crack comes in, and the whole thing falls apart. It's kind of very fragile. And I'm not saying it's easier to do, or it wasn't for me, but once I'd taken that first step of being able to see that just even the question, not even the fact whether whether he was the Lord or not, but even to be able to ask the question, is he the Lord? That itself was enough to start cracking the whole thing open.
And I mean, certainly from my perspective, having met you not that long after you'd left, and then having met you recently again as well, the journey that you've made in that time is just well noticeable. And I've actually found it quite encouraging that somebody could be that involved for so long and come through what must be a really quite difficult, almost traumatic transition period, and actually start coming back to themselves in such a short period of time, whereas somebody like me seemed to take a lot longer and went through a much longer sort of self-destructive period to work that through. So it just shows that everybody's responses afterwards is quite different.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that transition was traumatic. I mean, I really, 2001, I really suffered badly. I mean, it was almost thought I was going insane. Threw myself into lots of weird things. Fortunately, got out of them after a few days, but was just thrashing around like someone drowning, yeah. And it was very, very painful. I think one of the interesting things, though, this is how I rationalized it to myself. A lot of people met Miraji, you know, out of the blue, as it were.
Yeah.
Like he was a guru and the Lord, and they suddenly got into it. So when they leave at the end later, it's they're suddenly left high and dry. Well, for me, I joined Miraji even 30 years back originally for a purpose. I was in this Buddhist monastery. I was trying to make sense of my life. And Miraji was a shortcut or the way of doing that. So when I saw through him and the falsity of this whole position and what he was doing, I was able to go back to that initial impulse, which had been with me all the time. And, okay, obviously it was very painful. But I went back to Buddhism and went back to what I was doing. In fact, one of my favorite jokes, if I go to a Buddhist retreat and we're talking about, you know, how long have you been practicing Buddhist meditation, I often say I've been, you know, doing 35 years with a 30-year break in the middle.
I bet that gets a few laughs.
Yeah, it's my kind of standard joke, but it's true. It's kind of, you know, it's definitely true. You know, and now I look at those 30 years with Miraji as a break in my life. It's almost like you can take the two ends, how I was the day I met him and, you know, how I am now, and sort of put the two together and sort of, you know, fold in the 30 years. Not quite, but, you know, it's something like that. Sometimes I think.
You do feel in a way then that you've managed to reconnect to your younger self before you got involved, so that you've actually got a connecting thread.
Definitely. I mean, I think the way I'd put it now is just the ability to trust yourself and stand on your own feet and not to put your hopes or your dreams on, you know, something outside of yourself. That's the biggest thing. Miraji was the absolute maximum of taking your hopes and your dreams and your love and giving them to someone else, handing them over to someone else. Now, it doesn't help the fact that that someone you handed them over to has turned out to be, you know, completely deluded, in my opinion. If not a con man, at least deluded himself. but I think any human being must be in that category. I don't think you can ever hand yourself over to anyone and it'd be worthwhile for them. They can really take control of your life and do the best for you. You have to do it yourself. And actually, that's extremely liberating. So I've come very much back to that position. Maybe it's accentuated by the 30 years of how I handed it over to somebody else, but now I'm, you know, very jealous of just, you know, this is my life, and just really knowing where I stand, and if I'm going to take a step from where I actually am as opposed to where I think I should be, or, you know, have some theory or belief system of how the universe should be, but just actually see it as I see it and move from that point. So I'm kind of, that's my big thing. That's what I feel strong about. And it's probably as a result of the 30 years doing the opposite.
Yeah.
It's also helped me to come out of it and, as I said, you know, sane and healthy to some extent anyway.
Well, that's nice that it's better than nice. That's a rather trite word to use, but rather good that you've managed to come out with some positive stuff from that. And maybe I'm assuming, like, going on to the next track, which is Lafayette by Michel Malone, if I remember.
Malone, yeah.
Yeah. And is that from, I don't know the track at all, and I don't know the person. Maybe you could describe a little bit about where that comes in for you.
Yeah, well, when I sort of got back again into music a little bit, not to the extent I was before, but a little bit, my first thing was to go back to the 30, back to what it was like before I joined Miraji, which is a bit of a stupid thing to do, but it's the initial thing. And then I realized it kind of, I don't know, I was going to say it sounds dated. Actually, sometimes it sounds dated, but sometimes it doesn't. But at least what I wanted to do was to capture that same spirit, but someone who was, you know, alive and working now. And there's a whole number of, you know, I think there's enormous talent now and in the last 10 years, I realize, musically. People who don't make it on the big labels, but people who are just it really, the music's as good as it ever was. It's different, it's changed, it's split into lots of different genres, and they all fight amongst themselves, but there's a huge amount of talent there. If you just, especially with computers, you take a little while to click away through a few websites, you can really find some stuff which grabs you. Michelle Malone, she's what you might call folk rock.
All right.
A lot of her music is quite gentle. I chose this one, Lafayette, because it's a little bit raucous. It's more to match the earlier tracks. It's more like it's an example for me of a kind of liberation of just. Yeah, it's the same. It's got the same vibe as before, but it's also different. It's also 30 years on.
Yeah.
She's not so well known. There's quite a number of these kind of styles. So I like listening to this music. It's different enough, and yet it's similar enough to what I was into before.
All right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, for definite. And makes a lot of sense to me in terms of making that transition. And another of my really close mates has done something very similar, trying to find reconnections with where he was beforehand, but also now.
Right.
So that it's not just some, self-whipping nostalgic thing, but it's actually fresh and alive and means something in the moment.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. You can't ignore the past. The past has happened.
Yeah.
Wasn't it some famous philosopher said, those who don't learn the mistakes of the past are condemned to repeat them or something.
Yeah.
And that's horrific, actually, to think that I might repeat those. Got a minute? This is very real for me. Just a very quick story.
Right.
One of the early Buddhist retreats I went to just after leaving Maharaja when I was still, all at sixes and sevens. This guy, a friend of mine, said, "Beware of the fact that you might. This guru worship is like in your blood.
Right.
And the fact you've rejected Maharaja might mean you go off on somebody else."
Right.
And I thought, that's absolutely ridiculous. I've learned my lesson for sure. But yet I went into this Buddhist thing in California for a week or two, and immediately I started behaving to the abbot like he was a guru. Actually, he was doing his best not to be guru-like. I remember we were in a forest, and we had a little path to sweep. So I just finished sweeping my path and put the broom down when I saw him in the distance coming. So I grabbed the broom and started sweeping again, even though the path was clean, just so he would see me. Oh, there's this great devotee, Mike Finch, over there sweeping his path. And when I realized, it was just made me completely sick. So this idea of you have to learn from what you've done, and yet you can't whip yourself. You have to move on, but move on from where you are. That's what I'm saying. And where you are is part of where you've been.
For definite. So let's have Michelle Malone's Lafayette.
Down from the black mountain snow, and ever.
no, that's definitely, and I can see that chunky vibe in there as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, for definite. No,
it's great. She is great. There's a lot of, there's so much talent out there that I can't, you know, I'm completely amazed. When I go to one of these alternative music sites and just click away, you know, I'm amazed. A lot of bad stuff, of course.
Well, that's always been the case, hasn't it?
But so much good stuff like this.
And the last track, again, somebody that I don't know, Lisa Gerrard, and a track called Elegy.
This is interesting, because Lisa Gerrard was just another one of these people. She's not folk, she's more sort of... In the 90s, she was part of a band called The Dead Can Dance. I think Pat Cassidy or some with him. And they were very much into what you might call gothic rock.
Right.
Not actually rock, but sort of gothic. Now, the interesting about this particular tape, Elegy, track Elegy, was it was... I don't know if you've seen the film, the movie Gladiator.
No, I haven't.
you know, there's... I thought it was great. I've seen it a few times, and both in the beginning and the end of the film, this track is being played. I didn't know it was Lisa Gerrard at the time. And it's a kind of a haunting. It's quite different from the other tracks, more like a sort of haunting but powerful, you know, female voice against sort of powerful background. So I first heard this particular track again when watching the movie, but I found it incredibly moving, and I think it was even probably in the movie, because this guy, the gladiator Russell Crowe, he gets killed and he walks off in through death. He sort of goes through this hole in the wall, this gate in the wall, this door in the wall, as a presumably a metaphor for death, and goes through this cornfield meeting his wife and kids who had died before him. And it's great cinema. I mean, really good pictures. And the whole scene really moved me the first time I saw it. And this particular song adds to the atmosphere considerably. So having been really taken by the song plus the movie, I decided to go into the music of this person. It took quite a while before I could find out that the person who actually sung that track on the movie was this Lisa Gerrard. And I think it's a kind of a nice track to end with, because it is kind of where I am now. It's, I don't know how to describe it. It's, we're obviously going to play it so everybody can judge for themselves. But to me, as I said, that the prime thing about music is I need to get taken somewhere. And not get taken. I need to take myself. I need to make the steps, but obviously I need help and I need support.
Yeah.
I need love from other people. And music is one of those things. Music is a nice prop. It gives you good feelings. It can't do it for you. I think that was my mistake of the past.
Yeah.
Thinking the music could do it for me. It can't do it for me, but it's a nice backdrop to take my own steps. And that's the spirit in which I listen to music like this next track now.
Right, well, that's a nice introduction to Lisa Gerrard and Elegy. No, that was a really nice track, Mike. I really like that. And to be honest, coming from a very different musical like background at the moment, I could well see that being played out at some of the chill out do's that I go to. It's really lovely.
Yeah, it's kind of describes I think where I am now, to some extent.
And if you had to pick one track out of those eight on your desert island.
I think now, if I was on my desert island and I was only allowed to take one track to play while I was there, it would be Elegy, the one we've just listened to.
Right.
If I had to pick out the most significant in my life, I think it was Rock Around the Clock. I mean,
yeah,
it was
where it all started for you.
That's where it started.
Yeah.
It was most significant. Hugely significant.
All right, okay, so well, it's the top and the tail ones. And you've got a choice of either, well, used on the old desert islands, it used to be a book, but you could also have a movie or really any cultural artifact, really, that you'd like to take with you as well. Just one.
Oh, my goodness, I wish you'd give me some warning.
Yeah, no, sorry. I always forget. I don't know, there's some devilish part of me that forgets to warn people about this and puts them on the spot, but... And if you can't, don't worry. I mean, it's not like the end of the world at all. But
I think if I was going to have something that would keep, if I'm really going to be on a desert island, meaning like with no one or nothing around
yeah.
me, and you know, obviously, you know, having a lot of time to fill, I would obviously take an artifact which would, you know, keep me occupied for a long time. Now, this might sound really corny, but something like the works of Shakespeare. I've just been reading some of Shakespeare recently. Actually, I was cleaning out a bookshelf and I found this old complete works of Shakespeare, which I thought, oh my God, I almost threw it away. And then I thought, no, I put it somewhere. And then it found itself next to my bed and I found myself the other night reading it. And I thought, wow, this is certainly keeping me busy. I think if I was allowed two artifacts, I think I'd probably have one of the, you know, 10th or 11th century statues of the Buddha. But I think some of them are not particularly. I'm so into Buddhism because I'm not. It's my own version of Buddhism anyway, which is quite different from what a lot of people think of as Buddhism. But just as artifacts, some of those statues I think were the most sublime carvings anyone's ever done of a human being at peace. Take aside all the religious content of Buddha,
no,
but just a human being at peace, the most incredible faces on some of those, you know, old statues.
I can relate to that big time. I went through a long period where, even though I was not a Buddhist at all, there was something about those sculptures. I don't know if we're talking about exactly the same era and stuff. I'm not even sure where the ones I like came from. But there is something, well, exactly as you've just described. And luxury item. What luxury item? And really, in bend the rules here, I mean, I had a solar-powered laptop on my one with a satellite connection. you can really go as wild as you want on this, or as banal, or whatever. And again, sorry, we didn't mention this either.
A luxury item, I know. Yeah, the thing about, I know, the computers and everything, I'm not quite sure. I think I'd either want the best or none.
Right.
I'm still a little extremist. Right, the middle right. paths. The middle paths always eluded me.
Right.
I think I'd either, you know, the luxury item would either be, you know, yes, the best computer with obviously, you know, high speed satellite connection and all the rest of it, or none whatsoever. And if I had none whatsoever, I think the luxury item I'd have most is to have Egyptian cotton sheets to sleep in.
Right, okay,
that's important. I love having comfortable sheets.
Right, okay, yeah, I like that. That's a little bit of a different take as well. Right, well, thanks for that, Mike. I don't know about anybody else who's listening, but I found that really informative, and I should definitely be going back to listen, and especially during that, obviously, the shared culture part. I felt there was some quite interesting information coming through there about that whole journey. So thanks ever so much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate you asking me, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk. I think you compared it pretty good. I feel pretty good about this. I have a very good feeling from what happened. What anybody else will hear from it, I have no idea.
Yeah, well, you never know, do you?
You never know. But right now, I feel really good about it. Thanks.
So, and catch you all soon, hopefully. Bye.